The battle for a decentralized future is occurring on many different fronts, with many different technologies. And while we race toward a KYC everything future, we are at the same time redefining foundational pieces of technology that will make KYC obsolete. And it may very well be a race toward the most foundational piece of all of our technology stacks, the hardware itself, that will end up determining our future. Returning author Emile Fanouf breaks it down in today's article on the technological and disruptive impacts of Bitcoin, AI, and 3D printing. And not only what do they mean in isolation, but what do they mean together? The best in Bitcoin made audible. I am Guy Swan, and this is Bitcoin Audible. What is up, guys? Welcome back to Bitcoin Audible. I am Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. And we have got returning author Emile Fanouf, who read the Mises Regression Theorem article of, which I really, really loved. I really thought that was a fantastic episode and solid logical breakdown or logical deduction from just the very concept of what we think about value and how the regression theorem, with some specific exception to the fact that, you know, money wasn't used for something else, that it had to have some other arbitrary utility. I think it just makes extremely obvious sense that that's not the case at all. That if value is subjective, then it is subjective. End of story. And he makes a fantastic argument in that one. I'll make sure to have that link in the show notes. Again, that is Mises' Regression Theorem, Bitcoin, and the Subjective Theory of Value. I can't remember exactly what read it is, but again, if you just look down right in the description of the show, you will find it. And you will also find our amazing sponsors, which are CoinKite, the makers of the cold card hardware wallet to keep your Bitcoin safe, and Swan Bitcoin, the place to buy Bitcoin and to get on a Bitcoin standard. And for the next $10,000, there are no fees for buying Bitcoin on Swan Bitcoin, so check that out. And I'm not sure how long that lasts, so especially right now with Bitcoin being boring and stable, holy crap, this is a prime opportunity to get some stacking in. With that, let's go ahead and get into today's read. Again, it is by Emile Fanouf, and this one is on Bitcoin Magazine. And this one is bringing together a bunch of different technologies. Is looking at the big picture of, and really zooming out, like what happens at 30 years, 50 years, like what are the major trends, what are the major technological shifts that are causing, in the thesis of the sovereign individual, that are causing strong or huge dynamic shifts in the economics of violence, those things that truly reshape the world. What are those things? How do they work together or against each other, and what might we expect in the future? So without further ado, let's jump into the article. And it's titled, Decentralization and Local Manufacturing, Bitcoin, AI, and 3D Printing, by Emile Fanouf. A look at the similarities between AI, 3D printing, and Bitcoin in terms of their disruptive potential as decentralized technologies. In the 1997 book, The Sovereign Individual, William Rees-Mogg and James Dale Davidson make a convincing case that again and again throughout history, the dominant power of the day was disrupted by new technologies. Advances in agriculture meant that people and their property were often geographically stationary, making them sitting ducks for, quote, specialists in violence, the predecessors to modern governments, who back then were both the plunderers and protectors against plunder. The stirrup, contoured saddle, spur, and curb bit had a combined similar disrupting effect, shifting power away from heavy cavalry to a single armed knight. The gunpowder revolution disrupted the feudal order of the day, reinforced in those days by the Catholic Church. Rees-Mogg and Davidson write, quote, "The church tended to make religious virtues of its own economic interests, while militating against the development of manufacturing and independent commercial wealth that were destined to destabilize the feudal system." The printing press disrupted the church even further, causing it to lose its monopoly on biblical narrative. The result was a major loss in its influence and power, which gave way to the modern nation-state. Rees-Mogg and Davidson argue that the microprocessor would inevitably disrupt the nation-state in the same way that the printing press disrupted Christendom a few hundred years ago. The internet itself, a globally interconnected community, and public key cryptography, which protects both communications and property of Bitcoin, are made possible by microprocessors. The present and the future. One major battlefront for decentralization is fought on the currency front. Since Bitcoin's 2009 inception, we have been able to transact permissionlessly, borderlessly, and often anonymously. Nation-states have long been jealous of any challenge to their monopoly on money, and they will spend vast sums of money to ensure that there are no serious monetary rivals. Bitcoin serves as an alternative to that trap, which is why it is under attack by the likes of politicians and the crumbling legacy media. But to transact on Bitcoin, you need miners. No doubt regulators in the United States and Europe observed as China outlawed Bitcoin mining in 2021, which only resulted in the majority of the hashing power moving from that country to the United States. So while they would probably wish to ban it in the United States and Europe outright, they know that they would only lose both regulatory control and tax revenue from Bitcoin miners by doing so. Thus, for now, not even Elizabeth Warren, the most Bitcoin-hostile legislator in Washington, proposes to outright ban Bitcoin. Instead, she proposes to expand Know Your Customer or KYC rules to essentially all parties within the Bitcoin ecosystem, as well as discourage self-custody and privacy-enhancing technologies. Bitcoin does have an important weak point of centralization, for now. The hardware. The University of Cambridge produces industry reports on Bitcoin mining and communicates that, hardware-wise, the overwhelming majority of Bitcoin miners report to use an ASIC chip for mining Bitcoin's SHA-256 hashing algorithm produced by Singapore-based company Bitmain, with competitors MicroBT and Canaan trailing behind. Regardless of where Bitmain produces its ASIC chips, the ideal scenario for Bitcoin's decentralization would be that production of ASIC miners and the mining itself, for that matter, would be dispersed around the world so that no specific region could have a definitive advantage, taking the majority control of the hashing power. A reasonable compromise would be one in which ASIC miners were produced at scale and in high quality by at least more manufacturers than there are now, especially across countries that are not politically aligned with one another, so that collusion between them would be increasingly unlikely. A second major battlefront for decentralization is fought on the artificial intelligence front. I once attended a conference in which Peter Thiel participated as a speaker. He said something very close to the following, quoted from my memory. Quote, "Bitcoin is a technology that, on net, favors the individual. AI is a technology that, on net, favors the state." It is the latter technology and its favoring the state that emphasizes the importance of getting it into the hands of as many participants as possible if we are to truly build a decentralized world. One risk to AI's decentralization is one that Bitcoin has in common, a potential future scenario in which hardware is monitored and must be registered by law. In the case of Bitcoin, that would mean miners must register their ASIC chips. In the case of AI, it could mean that even you or I would need to register graphics processing units, or GPUs, above a certain capacity, or in the case of software, that matrices must be registered. Guillaume Verdun, the name behind the now doxed alias Based Bef Jesus, highlighted this risk in a podcast with Lex Friedman, arguing that this could, quote, stop the open source ecosystem from thriving by executive order, claiming that open source LLMs are dual-use technologies and should be government controlled. Although executive orders could not kill Bitcoin, but could discourage some people from using it, similar reporting requirements for miners would likely, to some degree, impact Bitcoin's open source ecosystem. A third major battleground worth highlighting is 3D printers, assemblers, and other tools in the quote, maker arsenal. The maker movement hints at a future solution to the problem of centralization tendencies for Bitcoin and AI. Imagine a world with 3D printers and accompanying tools in most people's homes. If you could print your own high-quality ASIC Bitcoin miners and GPUs for running large language models, decentralization is light years ahead. We can ignore for a moment the futuristic scenario in which 3D printers and other quote maker tools are used to produce hardware for Bitcoin and AI applications. Even at present, at least one government is looking at the 3D printer with the same skeptical eye that the Catholic Church had for the printing press in the 15th and 16th centuries. New York State's Assembly Bill A8132, if passed into law, would require criminal background checks with fingerprints sent to the FBI in order to purchase 3D printers, quote, capable of creating firearms. It is reasonable to expect that various governments, fearing loss of their own centralized power, will continue to push registration and, quote, KYC requirements to maintain control of real space tools that facilitate decentralization in cyberspace. Note, the Soviet Union had similar controls on seemingly harmless products such as books, photocopiers, and fax machines, all of which facilitated the spread of information and thus threatened the regime. There were similar efforts to control the sale of fabric that could be used to build hot air balloons in East Germany to stop people from escaping to West Germany. See the 1982 American film Night Crossing and the 2018 German film Balloon that both document a real escape. Localized manufacturing, whether at home or in a so-called community fabrication laboratory or fab lab, is likely to come under increased hostility by various governments as 3D printers and other maker tools are able to produce even more sophisticated electronics. But for now, at least, fab labs are growing exponentially in number, with well over 2,000 of them spread around the world so far, and even receive various levels of support by governments. These fab labs, by the way, don't account for the many more personalized labs in people's homes. Neil Gershenfeld at MIT's Center for Bits and Atoms tries to understand what the world looks like when almost anybody can make almost anything, and when machines can make other machines, even machines more sophisticated than themselves, and often with locally sourced materials. Gershenfeld argues in a podcast appearance that localized manufacturing doesn't scale, and that production is generally for personal use, not commercial sale. But when many thousands of people around the world learn how to locally produce their own 3D printed and home assembled Bitcoin miner, and then combine their individual hashing power with others in a mining pool, and coordinate with one another over the Tor network, then the world starts to look much more decentralized. Conclusion. Bitcoin, AI, and 3D printers share a common theme of decentralization and disruptive potential for the nation-state. As both Bitcoin ASIC mining chips and GPUs used to run LLMs exist in real space, where nation-states are most dominant, governments may become increasingly hostile towards such hardware, requiring criminal background checks, KYC, etc. Interestingly, 3D printers, assemblers, and other quote maker tools could be used now or in the future for localized manufacturing, whether at home or in so-called fab labs, enabling a much more decentralized world. Meanwhile, on the policy front, criminal background checks and registration requirements for 3D printers and other maker tools, such as those proposed in New York's Assembly Bill A8132, deserve a skeptical eye and strong political pushback. This show is brought to you by not being stupid and holding your keys on a cold card hardware wallet. Oh, do you think you own the Bitcoin in that exchange? Do you think that your Bitcoin is safe on your crypto wallet that you downloaded for your phone? What you have with the exchange is a credit token. You have an IOU. And what you have with that wallet, you might hold your keys. It's really hard to say these days. If you do not know that wallet inside and out, and you do not know and trust the people who have developed that wallet, then you may very well be using a custodial service and not even know it. The simplest way to just know that you have your keys, that you own your Bitcoin securely and they are not exposed to your phone, and that you're not borrowing the pretend ownership from some exchange, is to get yourself a cold card, get yourself a good hardware wallet. You got tap signers. There's so many different tools for securing your Bitcoin that you can use easily. They're available right in the CoinKite store. And I will tell you my setup because I love it. I just paid a few people that I work with today, actually, and on the Nunchuck wallet, you can set it up with a cold card and set it up with a very simple thing and just use the NFC, or you can use a tap signer, which is even easier and faster. And I just know everything is generated from my cold card. My cold card signs the transaction, and I just tap to send the data back and forth from the phone to the cold card. It is easy, it is secure, and I sleep like a baby. I do not think about or worry about my mobile wallet at all, because I have a cold card. And you can get the new cold card Q, which has the larger screen, which can use QR codes, and even has a full QWERTY keyboard. Check them out, and don't forget my discount code and link is right in the show notes. A special thank you to CoinKite's Not Being Stupid campaign. Get yourself a cold card. All right. So, Emil Fanouf, we read the last piece by him on the show, with this piece on Mises' regression theorem and the subjective theory of value. And I loved that piece. I really liked his breakdown. And then this one just immediately caught my attention in digging through his other works, just because I love not only the ideas of like where the technological progress is headed and why these how many different kind of coinciding tools of decentralization there are, and how critical it is as we actually lead toward these massive tools of centralization at the exact same time. But one thing I think that is really discounted, which he doesn't talk about, he specifically says we're not really talking about the monetary element of Bitcoin, is the incredible centralizing pressure of the financing system. And this is something we've talked about in the Fiat series, in the guys' takes of this show, is the fact that the concept, the very nature of creating, of issuing new debt into a fractional reserve system, and then issuing new debt for things that cannot be paid for, is an incredibly centralizing force around already massive institutions, especially when it leads to inflation in the financial markets. So what you actually have is a dual feedback loop, where because something is big in the financial markets, because savings are basically eviscerated, they just bleed constantly, people can't avoid, they have no secure, independent way to hold value that doesn't expose that value to counterparty risk, that doesn't essentially hand it off to massive corporations. And because this leads to, they even say that this is why it encourages investment. But what that really means is it leads to a bunch of blind people who have no idea what investment even means to throw money at the stock market. And because they have lives, they have concerns, they have their own specialties, they do their job, they're not investors, they're not VCs, nobody has time to do that and a full-time job. And more importantly, to even be slightly good at it and to have a full-time job and to understand and produce value in some other way, just to be able to hold, just to be able to keep the value that they have already earned. So what happens? What you end up doing is pushing trillions of dollars of dumb money into the markets that should not be there. People who have no idea what they're doing, people who have no idea what to buy. And so you know what they buy? We know where they put the money? Into stuff that's big, into stuff that's easily recognized, into stuff that has big announcements and new products and sells the most stuff. And because of this, all of those things just persistently go up in price. They outpace inflation because there is always going to be a tendency. It's just like the nature of money itself, the network effect of money, is that the reason you don't really have competing monies is because as soon as one becomes an outsized place to keep value and maintain value and be your denomination of trade, every time you decide to hold value in money A as opposed to money B, it is explicitly reinforcing the benefit of A at the direct cost of B. B gets less valuable, which means that even if you want to quote-unquote diversify, you have a substantial risk in not putting your value in money A, because if it is seen as the dominant one in any way, shape, or form, it is always going to outpace the value and the network effect of the other. There's a huge direct trade-off in the fact that you can't have value in both at the same time. Therefore, it ends up with a shelling point, and everybody ends up gravitating toward the same money. Well, a very similar effect happens in the stock market, is people don't know what to invest in, and it makes no sense to just, you know, broadly, like, the amount of risk in investing is so huge, you can't just, like, throw it at a bunch of penny stocks, and if you did, all it would do was would explode, it'd be like spam on Twitter or something. It would just 1,000x the amount of pointless, empty penny stocks to invest in that have no product and no service and have no expectation of growth, just trying to get the flood of money of dumb investors trying to get some sort of return. So what do? They just go to some big index and they say, oh, these 500 companies are big and they've gone up in price, you know, average of 7% for the last 5 years. Well, I'll just stick my money there. What's in the list? I don't know. It's the big stuff. So now this is just what everybody does. Everybody just comes in and they just do the easy thing. And the easy thing is always to reinforce incumbents that already have a strong position. So it appears as if these companies grow at staggering rates, that they're actually increasing in value all the time and that they're a safe place to park money. But it's not. It's got nothing to do with the value or market growth, genuine market growth, of those companies. It's the fact that they get more access to capital because people have no idea where to put it, and there's more capital coming into the system because it's being issued constantly. It is a 1,000% self-fulfilling prophecy because everybody thinks it's a place to park money. Everybody parks money there, which means the price of it all goes up, which makes it look like the place to park money, which also means it looks like they're a great financing opportunity. So who gets the new debt? Why would you take a risk on some small company that's actually doing something innovative, that's actually doing something of consequence and making some sort of a change in the economy when you can already get 10% just by sticking it into Apple? When in a natural market economy, they would not be the ones to loan money to because they would require the biggest loan and they already have a saturated market. They have the least likelihood of making a substantial return on it. If you already have 1 billion customers, there's only so much more growth that you can experience. If you have 100 customers, you can 10x to 1,000 customers pretty easily with a decent product. And funny enough, those are the exact people who need the funding. Apple doesn't need funding. Why are we all investing in Apple? Why do they get zero interest loans? None of this would naturally occur in a sound money economy. There would not be this appearance of just blanket growth in the stock market that occurred every single year for no reason whatsoever. That's not real growth. You are looking at the flip side of the coin. You're looking at the reflection of the increased money in circulation. That is it. And the fact that it tends to go more towards giant corporations than anything else, which makes them apparently more finance worthy, more credit worthy, which means that big banks they don't have to do their job of actually finding credit worthy good businesses that need credit anymore. They can just loan to big people. Just give money to huge institutions, because look, they always go up in value. People think they're safe, so people are going to reinvest their money in it, and people are going to keep earning more money because we're printing more money, and therefore it's a giant virtuous circle of make everything bigger and centralize into bigger corporations. If you break any piece of that circle, of that feedback loop, where people can just store their value in money that doesn't suck, well, then they're less likely to put it in the stock market. If a bunch of dumb money isn't just arbitrarily putting a bunch of capital into giant corporations for no reason other than to keep the money that they already earned, well, then they don't just naturally go up in price for no reason at all. And if people are actually exiting their value from the money that is being printed endlessly, the cost of that financing and going into debt continues to increase. It notches up. Every single person who exits the system, it notches that price up a little bit more. The real price of taking on that debt, of printing that liability, becomes more and more apparent. And it is less obscured by all of the people just flooding money into the stock market. And then when that perpetual feedback loop of just big stuff just goes up in price starts to diminish, and people start to weigh the decision of investing in them, of directing capital toward those institutions, against how much purchasing power they expect their Bitcoin to increase in, well, suddenly that return on those big companies isn't really that great anymore. It notches lower and lower until it's about the same or even less than inflation, because there's a huge counterparty risk. Because you literally have to give all of your money over to a giant financial institution that's going to charge you fees for keeping the money that you already earned. That feedback loop breaks down. And that is going to help these alternative economies explode. It is going to bring out their moment to shine. The monetary shift that is going on is going to expose the underlying need and the vast market for this alternative economy, for the gig economy, for the makerspace, for the fab labs, all of these things, and for open source AI at the same time. It'll be slow going because it's like watching a giant fall. Like, it's going to happen very, very slowly. And this giant isn't just like a really tall dude. This giant is like the size of the moon. If we were watching the moon break apart, we're going to be watching it for decades. Now, going back to this article in particular, I'm not sure. I have a problem with the ease of the claim. Granted, you know, on a long enough time scale, I think he's onto something. But the ease of claiming that 3D printing will be creating electronics. Now, I don't think we're far away from kind of the Raspberry Pi sort of days of that, in, you know, looking out 3 years, maybe 4 years. And interestingly enough, I think AI is actually going to help that a lot, is the ability to create circuits easily and generate these things in a more open environment. But there is still a massive gap, like a huge gap, in the manufacturing capacity and capability and precision of things like 3D printers and ASIC chip manufacturing machines that can make an ASIC chip of any consequence whatsoever. I mean, we're talking 4-nanometer chips, and I want to see this future of 3D printing and home manufacturing where chips are on the table, where like a microprocessor is legitimately part of the potential. But unfortunately, I think we kind of have to replay the entire manufacturing history from the 80s of microprocessors in general, in order to, like, we really have to catch up. And we can't do it in the closed source way. We have to do it in an open source way. And the question is, if it's going to take us another 10 years, where is the closed source alternative? Where does that end up? And do they actually ever meet each other? Or is it just a constant lagging indicator of the open source has old technology that's interesting and helps free, you know, part of the world, but it's not really consequential in the the larger scheme of, you know, power projection and the dynamics of power and authority when it comes to, I guess, just hashing power as an example for Bitcoin. But I guess probably in the same vein, we could say the same thing about NVIDIA and AI and GPU and AI-specific chips. I'm actually less pessimistic about AI models themselves. The explosion of fine-tuning and, you know, Llama 3 and a bunch of these Grok and everything, like a bunch of these larger models that have been made open source and available and quantized to run on all sorts of machines. I'm actually really optimistic about the models themselves. I think AI, the tool, so to speak, the software, is far more likely to be commoditized. The hardware, though, as he says, I mean, this is basically the thesis of the article, right, is that the hardware is extremely centralized, and it is still a massive point of failure. And if you build some sort of a backdoor, or you have some explicit control over the hardware industry and the manufacturing of these things, you have a big problem. You have a serious vulnerability. And both fortunately and unfortunately, in a couple of different senses, depending on how your perspective is for Bitcoin to be secure, is you have to decentralize and secure the entire stack. Like, all of it is relevant to Bitcoin's basically nuclear-grade robustness, so to speak. But unfortunately, I think the distribution of manufacturing capital is going to be the most difficult hurdle to overcome because of the incredible economics of scale necessary to make it viable, to make it economically profitable, and not just a massive suck, so to speak, just a massive drain on the capital of everybody who invests in it. And then the more centralized that it is, obviously, the easier it is to then control and know who it is that's operating and running these things. So I think the process of decentralizing the hardware manufacturing space, it's a lot easier to decentralize basic, like, cheap products and services, right? Like the beauty of the internet and the reason we are able to decentralize so much with the internet is because the end devices are so unbelievably cheap and so capable of running anything and everything on the network itself. And this is another important reason why I started the Pair Report, and why I think this is actually an incredibly important piece of the whole puzzle, is, again, finding ways to decentralize the communication layer. Because at every single layer, there are risks, there are trade-offs, and there are ways in which central control, surveillance, and restrictions on certain types of communication can be re-implemented, especially where we have centralized into massive platforms for essentially all of our, you know, market square discussion and gossip and socializing. I think this is one of the, if not the most profound risk when it comes to the social and political sphere. So being able to redistribute, not in the sense of, like, not in the political sense, but create a more distributed social sphere with the likes of Nostr and the Pair runtime, the Pair stack, I think is an exceptionally important task to overcome. And I think the best way to just demonstrate it is, how many times have we seen the Samurai Wallet website, the Silk Road, you know, whatever it is, somebody who's providing a service, someone who has no victims, someone who's being censored on social media, whose websites have gotten shut down, that have this... That our main way to communicate with them gets replaced with that badge that, you know, Federal Bureau of Investigation has taken down this evil website and this terrible opinion and this awful service where people actually get privacy. How many times during the COVID crisis did we see legitimate, like, extremely professional, long-standing, high-accolade doctors get their accounts removed for not falling in line with what pharma wanted them to say. If we cannot even get information across, then the idea of, like these things feedback on each other, right? Our limitation, a massive stress in the communication and organization of teams, of people in creating some sort of a task or a project and completing something, the friction there and the inability to organize freely and permissionlessly is a massive drain on the ability to create open hardware, is a massive drain on the ability to create open and privacy-centric software, to create AI that is open source and extremely capable. And then add to that the inability and difficulty of sharing value, of making payments to each other, of sharing resources with whether it be computers, whether it be materials, whether it be distributing and shipping around goods and services. Every single layer affects every other layer. And so my general pessimism around the idea of home manufacturing or small-scale manufacturing achieving what we would need to have such a substantial impact when it comes to specifically the hardware component, the computer hardware component, chips and GPUs and processors and this sort of thing. I have an extremely, like that's way, way, way out there in the future. Despite that, I also cannot discount how quickly progress could continue to speed up, how much it could accelerate if we have an open means of sharing resources, if we have instant lightning payments among large groups of people who are working together, if we can share resources to make better and more fine-tuned and more very task and knowledge-specific AI tools to benefit and assist in this. And where I think 3D printing is incredibly potent, is a massive game changer right now, is in the 3D printing of weapons. It is in the very thing that they're desperately trying to KYC and, you know, put controls in the 3D printing manufacturing space for basically like every printer has a, I think it's like a hash or something that checks what you're printing against whether or not you're printing money. Whether you're trying to print something that looks like a dollar bill, you can't do it if you've ever tried it. They want to do the same thing with guns, but they'll never pull it off. I don't think that's feasible because the maker community is too, the decentralization of that technology is too broad already, in the sense that it's so easy to make a 3D printer with a 3D printer, and you're specifically talking about essentially a hobbyist environment or community, whereas people who buy printers, like a inkjet printer, the inkjet printer can't build itself. You know, you can't turn around and make a better inkjet printer with an inkjet printer. And there's not really some vibrant community of building inkjet printers. Whereas 3D printers are very, 3D printers, CNC machines, like all of these things, you're almost just as likely to find a kit to put one together as you are to find one that is, you know, from a very final, like end product sort of manufacturer. And they're the end product manufacturer version isn't really that much better. Like, you can get all of the same capacity and precision out of one built from relatively available and low-cost pieces or materials and components as you can getting a quote-unquote an official maker bot or whatever it is you're buying. And already 3D printing is changing the world, whether or not it's got anything to do with making hardware components and, you know, small computers and that sort of thing. I don't think that's meaningful if it is happening to any degree, really. But I don't think that's a meaningful part of the process. I think it's actually far more in line with the whole gunpowder revolution, is that the ability to easily and at low cost manufacture secure, long-lasting weaponry at home. Like, we have seen the FCG, FCG, I think, two. There's, like, a couple of models. Like, I can't remember. I read an article not too long ago of the FCG design, which is a very popular, which stands for F Gun Control, or FGC. I think I said CG. FGC it's been seen on the battlefield. Like in actual wars with rebels and in state, especially in, I think it was somewhere on the African continent last I heard. I think maybe in Yemen? Where was it? I don't know. I haven't seen the article in a bit, and I did a cursory scour through Telegram just to see if it was in my saved articles, and I must not have saved it there. I hate that. God, I hate that. Not being able to find stuff that I saved is so frustrating. But anyway, the FGC has been seen on the ground. Like, it has been seen in war. And then the exact same implications when we are talking about drones and the ability to create very small, very low cost, and very maneuverable and fast drones, flight devices that can do all sorts of things, especially when we're talking about in the defense against drones. As these things become more and more prevalent in war, in warfare, I think we will increasingly see them specifically designed to be and designed in competition with each other, where the design is meant to, of a drone is designed to take out a drone. So you have an expensive drone from the state or from a military or police, and a very small, inexpensive, and fast drone from, you know, a 3D printing that is meant to specifically take out the big expensive drone. And all of this, in referencing Rees-Mogg and Davidson's book, or referencing The Sovereign Individual, all of this is dependent upon the economics of violence. And that's what's really potent here. Is as these things feedback on each other and give far greater scale of resistance from a far humbler position, from a starting position of the individual, of the home, of tiny groups of people, as that expands and multiplies and reproduces in more and more communities, in more and more the minds of more and more individuals, and in more and more homes, we see people taking that kind of sovereignty step of, maybe I can build my own thing. Maybe I can do this. Maybe if I had a 3D printer, I wouldn't have to worry about this or the KYC or a background check or whatever it is. And as it becomes more clear that we can manufacture among ourselves and we can share these resources and we can make payments without central parties, I think it's a slow. I mean, relatively speaking, historically speaking, it's very fast. I mean, you think about, you know, the amount of time it took for the printing press to cause a revolution in the church. You know, we were talking about the 15th and 16th centuries. We're talking about 200 years here. What does this look like in 30 years? And we don't have one decentralizing force. We have a multitude of them. We have new communication protocols. We have new encryption protocols. We have Bitcoin and monetary protocols on top of Bitcoin. We have payment protocols. We have privacy protocols. We have 3D and additive manufacturing at a small, medium, and large scale now. And now we have potentially commoditized intelligence. And I'm not really super convinced of the Peter Thiel quote, actually, that he brought up of AI is going to benefit the state and not the individual. Like, it does. It does benefit large platforms, but I'm not so sure it's the same scale of improvement or the same scale of power increase as it has on the individual. In the case of the individual having their own access or their own ability to utilize non-corporate AI. basically like Venice AI, chat unleashed or unleashed.chat, self-hosting, like a lot of things that I do, that sort of thing. Granted, even still with devs who can't code, we are still mostly just using ChatGPT. But I've also come up with I've started to explore a handful of alternative setups, and wholesale, I think, which we talked about on the pair report, is really kind of changing the dynamic of what I can actually easily do on my own machine. And I'm really, really excited to start putting all the pieces of this puzzle together. And I will 100% be keeping you informed on that. So don't forget to subscribe. Don't forget to check out AI Unchained and the Pair Report, because both of those will have a lot of self-hosted discussions and explicit setups to how we can basically push ourselves toward that future. And because I think that future happens one individual at a time, literally, is how do we get a setup that works for us and where we can distribute, where we can self-host, where we can be our own bank, and then teach that and even simplify that process for the next person so that they can do it even easier. And I guess that's kind of what I am trying to do, right? That's why I'm here, and what I want to be for everybody else is if I can figure it out and I can make it so that I want to use it, then that means it's easy. That means it's simple to set up. It's easy to replicate, because otherwise I'm not going to fight with it. And then I get to share it with you guys. So a huge thank you to Emil for this article as well. And always fascinating discussion, and love digging into the various technologies of decentralization and how they impact everything. So much more to come on that front. In fact, 3D printing is something that I don't think I've taken a deep enough dive into. And I feel like there are multiple different places where in our various shows, it is likely to pop back up in the not too distant future. So stay tuned. Don't forget to subscribe. Don't forget to check out our amazing sponsors, Swan Bitcoin and CoinKite. Don't forget to follow Emil Fanouf. And I will have links to his other articles at ire.org, as well as this one, if you want to check it out, and links in the show notes, or his Bitcoin Magazine, which is where this article was. And that'll do it. I am Guy Swan. This is Bitcoin Audible. And until next time, everybody, take it easy, guys. Mass production keeps the world divided between consumer and producer. Demassification of production may hasten the speed towards an era of prosumers. Michael Petch, from 3D Printing, Rise of the Third Industrial Revolution.